This recording accompanies the Language B Higher Level Examination, Paper 2, Listening Comprehension, for English, May 2025.
Cet enregistrement accompagne l'examen de Langue B, Niveau supérieur, Épreuve 2, Compréhension orale d'anglais, May 2025.
Esta grabación acompaña el examen de lengua B, nivel superior, prueba 2, comprensión auditiva, de inglés, mayo 2025.
The start and end of each audio text will be indicated by this sound.
Le début et la fin de chaque texte audio seront indiqués par ce son.
El inicio y el final de cada texto de audio se indicarán con este sonido.
The end of the examination will be indicated by this sound.
La fin de l'examen sera indiquée par ce son.
El final del examen se indicará con este sonido.
Text A. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear an interview between a journalist and a city councillor about service dogs.
Good morning, councillor. Thanks for meeting with me today to talk about service dogs. So, service dogs are trained to perform tasks for their handlers, who are often people with disabilities, right?
Yes, and they provide lasting friendships for handlers. The biggest benefit is they are a source of joy for those assisted by them, according to studies.
So, can any dog become a registered service dog? Do we just send it to a dog training program and get them certified?
Actually, while the city does organise dog training workshops, official certification does not exist at the moment.
Oh, so how does a handler prove to someone that their dog is indeed a service dog?
They need no more than a doctor's note if they are asked to show any proof by a business.
Or businesses can ask for a demonstration of the task the dog is trained to do, I suppose.
Under no circumstances is this allowed, because it infringes on the privacy of their handlers.
I see. And can a business refuse service dogs when someone in the shop has allergies or is scared of dogs?
These are all invalid reasons and could lead to serious consequences.
Okay. Let me write all this down. So, counselor, are you saying that a service dog can never be excluded from a public space?
Pretty much. Only when the handler fails to keep the dog under control can a business ask to remove it.
Like when it keeps barking?
Not necessarily, because it might be alerting its handler as part of the task.
I see. What are some responsibilities of a handler, then?
Basic things, like making sure the dog is not aggressive to strangers, nor too affectionate, and they should not let it run loose unrestrained.
Are these guidelines the same across the country?
They are now city-specific, but we're working to standardise a few things. For example, vests that say service dog come in a variety of styles now. In the future, we want to put a unique registration number on each in a uniform style, and you'll find them at authorised sellers only.
There are other clues to tell if a dog is a service dog, right? They're always medium or large dogs to start with.
Actually, it isn't a great indicator, nor the breed for that matter, but all service dogs are very attentive when working. That might be a hint.
Very interesting. Thank you.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Good morning, Counselor. Thanks for meeting with me today to talk about service dogs. So, service dogs are trained to perform tasks for their handlers, who are often people with disabilities, right?
Yes, and they provide lasting friendships for handlers. The biggest benefit is they are a source of joy for those assisted by them, according to studies.
So, can any dog become a registered service dog? Do we just send it to a dog training program and get them certified?
Actually, while the city does organize dog training workshops, official certification does not exist at the moment.
Oh, so how does a handler prove to someone that their dog is indeed a service dog?
They need no more than a doctor's note if they are asked to show any proof by a business.
Or businesses can ask for a demonstration of the task the dog is trained to do, I suppose.
Under no circumstances is this allowed, because it infringes on the privacy of their handlers.
I see. And can a business refuse service dogs when someone in the shop has allergies or is scared of dogs?
These are all invalid reasons and could lead to serious consequences.
Okay. Let me write all this down. So, Counselor, are you saying that a service dog can never be excluded from a public space?
Pretty much. Only when the handler fails to keep the dog under control can a business ask to remove it.
Like when it keeps barking?
Not necessarily, because it might be alerting its handler as part of the task.
I see. What are some responsibilities of a handler, then?
Basic things, like making sure the dog is not aggressive to strangers, nor too affectionate, and they should not let it run loose unrestrained.
Are these guidelines the same across the country?
They are now city-specific, but we're working to standardize a few things. For example, vests that say service dog come in a variety of styles now. In the future, we want to put a unique registration number on each in a uniform style, and you'll find them at authorized sellers only.
There are other clues to tell if a dog is a service dog, right? They're always medium or large dogs to start with.
Actually, it isn't a great indicator, nor the breed for that matter, but all service dogs are very attentive when working. That might be a hint.
Very interesting. Thank you.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text B. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear Mo speaking first with an esports player, then an event sponsor at a live-streamed esports tournament.
Hi viewers, this is Mo. Thanks for joining me live today at the 2025 Football Frenzy Tournament where esports players convene. I'm now with Tiana Williams, who won last year's tournament, and performed impressively in the qualifying match just moments ago. Tiana, say hi to my viewers before the quarterfinal.
Hi everyone, and thanks, Mo.
So Tiana, you've worked so hard to get to this point. Your parents must be proud to have such a diligent and talented daughter.
If only. I've been playing video games since forever, but the term esports was never in my parents' vocabulary. In their eyes, I was far from diligent, actually maybe lazy. Only after we moved here did they realize that it's a real deal. I tried to gain recognition by sharing gaming videos online, but in vain. I finally made a name for myself by joining a league.
Wow. Would you consider esports your lifelong career then?
Just like players in traditional sports, it's unrealistic to be an esports athlete forever. I do enjoy the instructional side of it, though. So at the moment, I'm working to become a coach.
So you'll continue to upload tutorials onto your streaming channel?
It's a crazy idea, but further down the road, I want to start an academy. That's my career aspiration.
That's awesome. All right, I'll let you go now and I'll go on with the tour. Good luck. Viewers, we now get a chance to speak with Jessica Lee from Cheer Soda, one of the event sponsors. Jessica, what attracted your company to sponsor this tournament?
We've been looking at the esports market because the growth of it has been exponential. It has a passionate fan base, and it combines sports and recreation. These give a lot of edge to the gaming industry and make it a promising investment.
And gamers and fans are constantly on the lookout for novel gaming experiences.
Right on. This entails giving more money to the development of cutting-edge technology to allow for gameplay that can be customized by players.
So other than sponsoring the tournament, how do you get involved with the gaming community?
One of our major initiatives is we upgraded the player lounge of this arena. We understand the importance of a space for players to unwind and exchange insights, so we've made an effort to create a welcoming environment for this to happen, from snacks to amenities, you know?
What's so special about the lounge?
The kitchen offers international cuisines, so players from other countries don't get too homesick. We also update the decor on a monthly basis. You'll see new wall art and a new colour scheme the next time you come. We even have on-site massage therapists providing service 24 hours.
That's pretty impressive.
To promote teaching and learning, we also have a training area in the lounge where novice and seasoned players can play video games together. It's subject to reservation at no extra cost.
Interesting. Thanks for the chat, Jessica.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Hi, viewers. This is Mo. Thanks for joining me live today at the 2025 Football Frenzy Tournament, where esports players convene. I'm now with Tiana Williams, who won last year's tournament and performed impressively in the qualifying match just moments ago. Tiana, say hi to my viewers before the quarterfinal.
Hi, everyone, and thanks, Mo.
So, Tiana, you've worked so hard to get to this point. Your parents must be proud to have such a diligent and talented daughter.
If only. I've been playing video games since forever, but the term esports was never in my parents' vocabulary. In their eyes, I was far from diligent, actually maybe lazy. Only after we moved here did they realize that it's a real deal. I tried to gain recognition by sharing gaming videos online, but in vain. I finally made a name for myself by joining a league.
Wow. Would you consider esports your lifelong career then?
Just like players in traditional sports, it's unrealistic to be an esports athlete forever. I do enjoy the instructional side of it, though. So at the moment, I'm working to become a coach.
So you'll continue to upload tutorials onto your streaming channel?
It's a crazy idea, but further down the road, I want to start an academy. That's my career aspiration.
That's awesome. All right, I'll let you go now and I'll go on with the tour. Good luck. Viewers, we now get a chance to speak with Jessica Lee from Cheer Soda, one of the event sponsors. Jessica, what attracted your company to sponsor this tournament?
We've been looking at the esports market because the growth of it has been exponential. It has a passionate fan base, and it combines sports and recreation. These give a lot of edge to the gaming industry and make it a promising investment.
And gamers and fans are constantly on the lookout for novel gaming experiences.
Right on. This entails giving more money to the development of cutting-edge technology to allow for gameplay that can be customized by players.
So other than sponsoring the tournament, how do you get involved with the gaming community?
One of our major initiatives is we upgraded the player lounge of this arena. We understand the importance of a space for players to unwind and exchange insights, so we've made an effort to create a welcoming environment for this to happen, from snacks to amenities, you know?
What's so special about the lounge?
The kitchen offers international cuisines, so players from other countries don't get too homesick. We also update the decor on a monthly basis. You'll see new wall art and a new colour scheme the next time you come. We even have on-site massage therapists providing service 24 hours.
That's pretty impressive.
To promote teaching and learning, we also have a training area in the lounge where novice and seasoned players can play video games together. It's subject to reservation at no extra cost.
Interesting. Thanks for the chat, Jessica.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text C. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a podcast on Indigenous identity fraud.
For decades, myriads of employment opportunities have been set aside for Indigenous peoples in this country. That's obviously great, but recently, we received an anonymous tip-off about how some prominent figures were taking advantage of these opportunities. We investigated and discovered that their claims of Indigenous ancestry were indeed very questionable. While they typically resign following such allegations, The focus of our discussion is on a broader problem: how widespread Indigenous identity fraud is, and the implications. Most people who purposefully make false claims about their Indigenous ancestry are not motivated by financial gains, but potential work promotion. Indigenous groups are increasingly speaking out about how rampant this is, especially in academia, with politicians joining those voices. One big loophole pinpointed by several Indigenous leaders is the reliance on self-identification. For example, in universities, no proof of candidates' Indigenous identity is necessary other than a checkmark on an application form. Also, fraudsters only get a slap on the wrist when caught, without any legal consequences. In terms of solution, an Indigenous ID system may work, but such a system takes too long to establish. For now, an attestation could be an alternative. In other words, make those who self-declare as Indigenous swear to it and let them know that it's legally binding. Moreover, it's not uncommon to see fraudsters adopting a conventional Indigenous name, so maybe we should check if their place of birth aligns with a claimed Indigenous identity. Let's now discuss the impact of this from a broader perspective. Indigenous identity fraud may not wipe out Indigenous cultures, but it deepens misunderstanding about them. For example, fraudsters often seek to portray a particular image that they think aligns with their claimed Indigenous identity. These images are often inaccurate. But the thing is, these fraudsters can go unnoticed for so long, partly because they take advantage of the public's assumptions about Indigenous communities. Many assume someone is Indigenous as long as they fit into these misconceptions. Moreover, some jobs specifically dedicated to the Indigenous communities are meant to enhance their authority, especially via the management of lands. Physical spaces are important for their livelihood, but to Indigenous communities, such spaces mean way more than property. They represent an identity. When fraudsters end up in these positions and start making uninformed decisions concerning lands, it defeats the purpose of Indigenous-led initiatives. But after all, a key starting point to address identity fraud is maybe to establish rapport with Indigenous communities by empowering self-expression. Actively listen to them instead of speaking on their behalf. That way, we can ensure their voices are heard. What are your thoughts on this topic? Leave us a comment.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
For decades, myriads of employment opportunities have been set aside for Indigenous peoples in this country. That's obviously great. But recently, we received an anonymous tip-off about how some prominent figures were taking advantage of these opportunities. We investigated and discovered that their claims of Indigenous ancestry were indeed very questionable. While they typically resign following such allegations, the focus of our discussion is on a broader problem: how widespread Indigenous identity fraud is, and the implications. Most people who purposefully make false claims about their Indigenous ancestry are not motivated by financial gains, but potential work promotion. Indigenous groups are increasingly speaking out about how rampant this is, especially in academia, with politicians joining those voices. One big loophole pinpointed by several Indigenous leaders is the reliance on self-identification. For example, in universities, no proof of candidates' Indigenous identity is necessary other than a checkmark on an application form. Also, fraudsters only get a slap on the wrist when caught, without any legal consequences. In terms of solution, an Indigenous ID system may work, but such a system takes too long to establish. For now, an attestation could be an alternative. In other words, make those who self-declare as Indigenous swear to it and let them know that it's legally binding. Moreover, it's not uncommon to see fraudsters adopting a conventional Indigenous name, so maybe we should check if their place of birth aligns with a claimed Indigenous identity. Let's now discuss the impact of this from a broader perspective. Indigenous identity fraud may not wipe out Indigenous cultures, but it deepens misunderstanding about them. For example, fraudsters often seek to portray a particular image that they think aligns with their claimed Indigenous identity. These images are often inaccurate. But the thing is, these fraudsters can go unnoticed for so long, partly because they take advantage of the public's assumptions about Indigenous communities. Many assume someone is Indigenous as long as they fit into these misconceptions. Moreover, some jobs specifically dedicated to the Indigenous communities are meant to enhance their authority, especially via the management of lands. Physical spaces are important for their livelihood, but to Indigenous communities, such spaces mean way more than property. They represent an identity. When fraudsters end up in these positions and start making uninformed decisions concerning lands, it defeats the purpose of Indigenous-led initiatives. But after all, a key starting point to address identity fraud is maybe to establish rapport with Indigenous communities by empowering self-expression. Actively listen to them instead of speaking on their behalf. That way, we can ensure their voices are heard. What are your thoughts on this topic? Leave us a comment.
You now have the rest of the time to finish answering the questions.